From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Glow up is the word that I kept seeing, which I had never heard before, but that's just because I'm out of touch.
I have not heard that word.
It's a glow up.
Okay, Kim, it's a glow up.
It's a glow up.
I think I need
it's
one of those.
It's a glow up of the year.
When the first trailer for Sonic the Hedgehog landed last spring, fans of the video game were horrified by the title character's look. So Paramount pushed the film's release back 3 months, and Sonic was sent back to the drawing board. The film seemed doomed to be yet another movie based on a video game that turned into a box office bust. Instead, Sonic delivered a boom. In 2 weeks, it raked in more than $100 million at U.S. theaters. Sonic the Hedgehog director Jeff Fowler tells us how he brought the blue guy back from the brink of disaster. But first on the News Banter, M-I-C-K-E, why did Bob Iger suddenly resign as the CEO of Disney? Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, this past week, Monday brought the Harvey Weinstein conviction, which was huge news, obviously, around the world. And then Tuesday brings Bob Iger's very abrupt resignation of CEO of the Walt Disney Company. And this caught Hollywood so off guard. I'm flattered by how many people in the Hollywood community thought I would understand what had happened because this was so unexpected. They were asking me what really led to this. Among many others, I don't exactly know. Bob Iger had been presiding over, of course, what will be a storied tenure as chairman and CEO of Disney. A string of hugely successful acquisitions, Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm, of course, Fox. The outcome on that one is still being processed, but these huge expansions turned the studio into a Death Star with the Marvel properties and the Star Wars properties and the animated stuff and, of course, the marketing, the merchandising, the theme parks. He's one of the legendary CEOs of business, period. He had said more than once that he was going to retire in X year. It became a little bit of a gag. Like Bob Iger says he's retiring in this year. Oops, now he's postponed it. So he had said he was retiring actually, I think, next year. And then we wake up and he is like, I'm out. Now, he's not leaving altogether. He's staying as chairman. He's got some role, he says, in content creation. But he named the head of theme parks, Bob Chapek, a guy who wasn't even seen as a serious contender for this job. And he would have to be busy in the content side because Bob Chapek is a theme park guy who has no experience creating content.
Yeah, that's the big mystery here is if the Disney board had such confidence in Bob Chapek, which they have said in interviews and in the conference call after the announcement, and they had known for some time, Bob Iger said, that they were going to go with Chapek as the new CEO, then why didn't they telegraph this at all? Why was the media and other observers left to speculate about other executives at the company like Kevin Mayer, who presided over the launch of Disney Plus, which was very successful, and Peter Rice, who came over with the Fox acquisition and has experience in film, television, news, and a bunch of the other things that Disney does. So yes, it may be just that this is what they say it is, and the board has thought of this for a long time, and they just decided a random Tuesday in February to announce it. But some have speculated that there may be other stuff going on that we just don't know about.
Yeah, we can't engage in that speculation, but it is definitely going on. You know, it's not only that Chapek has no experience in creating content. The streaming service is supposed to be it, and he has no experience in that area either. Kevin Mayer was in charge of that and launched Disney Plus, and everybody was like, well done, and didn't matter. So yeah, this has caught everybody very much off guard. Bob Chapek, you know, the theme parks within Disney, there's a bit of snobbery that the content people are somehow see themselves as superior to the theme park people. So a guy coming straight out of theme parks also is a strange thing. Now, he has had some very strong results in theme parks. However, for people who are sort of big, huge fans of the Disney theme parks and keep very close track of everything, they complain. They think he has cut costs too much. So I don't know whether they are going to see this as a plus for the whole company.
Well, no one ever got fired in Hollywood for cutting costs a little bit. So I don't think that was a big factor. The key thing for Bob Chapek is that he's been at the company for 27 years. The Parks Division has been a huge growth driver. You know, Bob Iger, in his book that came out last year, he talks a lot about the opening of Shanghai Disneyland in 2016, the $5.5 billion park that they opened there. He talks about it like it was his crowning achievement. And Bob Chapek was right there with him doing all of that. And the parks are a big part of the Disney brand and the revenue, and they have really, really grown that. They've had a little bit of problem with the Star Wars lands that they have opened, which haven't been the growth drivers they thought they would. And obviously now they're dealing with the coronavirus, which is going to hit earnings for the next foreseeable future. But in the grand scheme of things, the parks are a key part of Disney, so that may have tipped the scales for him.
Well, I think the Disney heritage, because, you know, Peter Rice was a relative newcomer. I don't know what got in the way of Kevin Mayer, but something did. But I will say, if you are Bob Chapek, you are inheriting a boatload of trouble, really, potential problems, because it is widely acknowledged that after a ridiculously successful year at the box office, something that you can't replicate, their box office will drop. Meanwhile, they're losing revenue that they used to get from Netflix and selling things to streaming services. They are plowing money into their own streaming service. This is going to be a brutal, brutal competition. And, you know, we have the unknown of the coronavirus, which, of course, could not only hit movie theaters, but theme parks.
Yeah, and it's only getting worse. And I think this is somewhat of a drop the mic moment for Bob Iger, where he says, okay, I'm at the top. There is a guy that the board is comfortable with. Let's just announce it. Let's not announce him as my heir apparent. You know, they went through that before, and, you know, it just gives the media 5-6 months to scrutinize someone. Let's just do it. He is going to stay on board. Chapek is actually going to report to him until the end of his contract in 21. And he'll get to do the creative stuff that he likes. He'll be able to groom this guy while he's in the job. And they think that that's a winning combination.
Yeah, I would imagine a lot of big filmmaking talent and creative talent is saying, who? I'm not sure how many of them really know him. But I will just contrast this with what happened at NBC Universal. You know, more normal. Steve Burke was laid the pipe to retire. He's sticking around until the spring. They named a success. I mean, that is more normal than this. So I don't know that people are going to feel like they really understand what went on here, but it is what it is. And we'll see how Chapek can handle these challenges. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
In the new movie Sonic the Hedgehog, the famously fast Sega video game character finds himself forced out of his happy home planet and stranded among real, live-action human beings on Earth. As a blue alien hedgehog, Sonic, voiced by Ben Schwartz, knows he should remain in hiding. But his presence accidentally becomes known, and Sonic is hunted by authorities who naturally want to dissect him. Sonic turns to small-town cop and good guy Tom Wachowski, played by James Marsden.
All right, get in the truck.
Really? You're gonna help me?
I guess it is a little bit my fault that all this is happening to you.
Not a little bit, entirely. It is entirely your fault.
It's entirely my fault. Are you coming?
Yes. Road trip! Whoop whoop!
From there, Sonic the Hedgehog indeed turns into a road trip movie, but making Sonic was another kind of trip altogether. When the first trailer for Sonic landed last spring, the reaction from fans was immediate. They hated Sonic's big screen look, especially his human-looking teeth and strange proportions. Paramount, which really needed a hit, pushed the release date from November to February, and the Sonic character underwent a major redesign. Still, it looked like Sonic might be yet another failed attempt to turn a popular video game into a movie. But when critics reviewed the finished film, they were pleasantly surprised. Forbes even asked, how in the world is the Sonic the Hedgehog movie actually good? In its first 2 weeks, Sonic scored more than $100 million at the domestic box office and another $100 million internationally. Sonic the Hedgehog is director Jeff Fowler's first feature. He spent his whole career at Blur, the effects house and production company run by Tim Miller. Listeners of the business may remember Miller has been on the show twice, first as the director of Deadpool, and more recently to do a postmortem on his second film, Terminator Dark Fate. Miller was an executive producer on Sonic. For Fowler, making Sonic follows a long, long relationship with the title character.
I love video games and played everything I get my hands on. And then Sonic came along and it really was a very one of a kind game changer. No pun intended. It was like just a fast game. And it starred this little blue hedgehog who had attitude and a lot of personality. And I think that was very new. But yeah, I think if you're going to spend 3 years of your life, if not more, working on a movie, you'd better love it. And Sonic qualified for me.
So let me just step back and talk about your professional life. You were born in Normal, Illinois. I don't know quite where Normal, Illinois is, but...
It's a sort of central Illinois, very small. Biggest thing the town has going for is probably that State Farm Insurance has their national headquarters there. And my dad actually worked for State Farm for 40 years. So it was a family thing. And family moved up a little bit further north to be in the suburbs of Chicago, which is a great place to grow up, and had a great childhood filled with loving movies and none more so than Star Wars very early on.
I heard you were a big Star Wars
fan. Star Wars fan. And it just made me kind of fall in love with movies and sort of the magic of visual effects. And yeah, that really kind of stuck with me in a big way.
So you decide to go to art school, or are you just one of those kids that was drawing? And
I was always drawing and having fun with painting or trying to do my little version of animation by doing drawings and flip books. But it took a while for me to really figure out, like, how does this love of art and movies, like, where do I go with this? And it actually really wasn't until early in my high school career that movies like Jurassic Park, which came out in 93, Toy Story 95, like, it just had this epiphany of like, oh my gosh, look what these digital characters and visual effects can do for storytelling, what they can do for film. I just completely fell in love with it and just knew that that's what I wanted to do.
This could be a job.
Yes, absolutely.
So you go to art college in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ringling School of Art and Design, just right there on the west side and on the Gulf Coast of Florida, which is a really great little beach town. And the school was this one of the few programs in the country that actually had a degree in computer animation. So it seemed like that was the place to be.
And then did you go directly from there to work with Tim Miller?
I did.
Tim Miller's like your godfather.
He plucked me out of my home in Wheaton, and he'd seen my short film that I had done at Ringling. That's how you basically spend your senior years. You produce a little short film. Mine was a minute long. It was called Monkey Pit. And I put it online, and it was basically your calling card for trying to get a job. And he saw it and really liked it and said, hey, why don't you fly out to California and see my studio and we can talk about work.
Tim remembers that your 1 minute thing had a monkey with sunglasses on.
Yes, a baboon with a pair of sunglasses fall into the exhibit at the zoo, and the baboon, having a very bright pink derriere, takes the sunglasses, puts them on his butt, and does a little dance to taunt the children that are calling out to him and making fun of him. Very simple, but I like to think that I executed the concept as well as it could be done.
And you're a monkey guy.
I have done my fair share of anthropomorphic animals, yes.
So you, at some point, enter this contest. Tim has a contest every year. I don't know if he still does. And I'm not sure that you can explain better what the contest was for.
So it's a short film contest. And the idea was really just to promote internal creativity because, I mean, even though we did a lot of great projects and we always put a lot of ourselves into them, you're still working for a client. So the beauty of the short film program was just to kind of show what we could do as a studio, like creatively, and that we can design creative projects. We can write scripts, we can storyboard to make these little short films. And it's very democratic. Basically, the way it works is the supervisors vote on the ideas. Whatever idea gets the most votes, that actually becomes the idea that the studio produces and actually puts some significant resources into it. So I wrote one called Gopher Broke, and it happened.
Gopher, like the gopher,
like
animal,
gopher,
just to keep,
yes,
it in the same world of mice, monkeys,
exactly,
gophers, and hedgehogs eventually. Go on.
So my idea won that year. And then, yeah, it was very fortunate that Blur then was going to put a team together and let me direct it.
So you created the idea for it, and then if you win, you get to execute. Is that how it works?
Right. There was never a guarantee of it. The only thing that was sort of promised from Blur's and Tim's side was that whatever idea wins, that they would sort of enter that into Blur's creative pipeline, and that how far you got just kind of depended on how good of a fit you were for as a director.
And now just to set us in time, this is it. By now we're at 2005. You made it, and it gets Oscar nominated for animated short.
Yes, that was a very exciting morning. I remember it well. One thing that's really great about the Academy is that they do acknowledge short films, both live action and animated, just because there's a lot of people out there that work really hard in these things. And I think it's great that they actually include that.
Do you think it made a difference for you?
I do. If nothing else, it got a lot of with the studio, with Blur, it got them comfortable with me. And I was able to continue directing because I had been through it on something like that. And then I was able to kind of settle in and start doing commercial projects or helping out with some of the video game promotional work we had done. But it definitely led to more directing opportunities. So yeah, which was great.
Coming up after a short break, Sonic the Hedgehog director Jeff Fowler tells us about breaking the video game curse. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Jeff Fowler, director of the new movie, Sonic the Hedgehog. Fans trashed the first trailer for the film after it dropped last spring, but all was well once the main character was redesigned. While the new and improved Sonic was undoubtedly critical to the film's success, there's another key ingredient. Jim Carrey, who plays the evil Dr. Robotnik with a performance that's a throwback to his comedy heyday.
The time for talking is over!
It's time to push buttons.
Your flying eggs are pretty impressive, Mr. Eggman. But let's face it, you'll never catch me.
Confidence. A fool's substitute for intelligence.
Even before the debacle of the first Sonic trailer, the idea of a Sonic the Hedgehog movie seemed risky.
The reality is many people have spent a lot of money and gotten very hurt trying to make video games into feature films. This, I think, is the first one that wasn't a debacle.
There have been a few others. Last summer, Detective Pikachu did well. I mean, there's always this phrase that's thrown around of like breaking the video game curse when it comes with movies. And right. I think movies are tough regardless. I think people like to believe in things like curses for some reason, just because it's fun to speculate. But it's hard to say like what defines, other than box office, like how do you define what would break this video game curse, right? So, I mean, from my standpoint, I never really thought of it as, oh, we're fighting this uphill battle of like, it's a video game movie. Like we did everything we could to really, for people to be able to enjoy the movie regardless. So,
although looking at what happened, that's so innocent because it's not like you got bit by the video game curse, but you almost got bit by the video game curse.
Right.
So this project, I guess, starts with Neil Moritz, the producer, and Sega in 2014. And Sega comes to Tim to ask him to direct the movie.
So we had done some work for Sega. So Sega really enjoyed working with us, and we kind of kept touch over the years. So yeah, after Deadpool came out and was this big success, Sega really got excited about doing a Sonic film and reached out to him. And Tim, as he had done when he got calls on a lot of different projects, when he knew it probably was not something that interested him or that he would be the right fit for, I literally sit next to him at the studio. So he would just turn his chair and say, what do you think about doing a Sonic movie?
Was there some reason to think you could take on a feature at that point?
No, but it's funny because it's almost a carbon copy of what Tim's experience had been. I mean, he was directing projects at Blur and doing a lot of the same kind of work. Deadpool comes along. He had done little proof of concept tests that had leaked at some point.
One of the great mysteries, but whatever.
Yes. Although I will say, as I'm sure Tim has denied it as well, that we had no part in that. So anyways, we didn't leak the test. But that trajectory and that sort of path that Tim had kind of had to walk with Deadpool, where he had next to no live action experience, and suddenly he's sort of put in this position of making a live action Deadpool movie. And what was great sort of in the wake of that was he would just share wisdom or experiences and over a long enough timeline, like, I mean, I really sort of tried to take all of that to heart and to sort of apply it when Sonic came along.
Were you scared?
You just kind of have to take it day by day. I mean, the funny thing is a lot in those early stages of development, you're working on the script you're working on concepts and designs for the film, but you don't know with any certainty that this is going to go. Like, you hope it does, but by no means is it ever like, oh yeah, we're absolutely making this. You kind of just continue working on it with the hope and the faith that yes, they're going to, the studio will say yes, and the money will flow, and the plans will be made, and we'll be making a movie.
And it did get put in turnaround at Sony.
Correct. So it had started off at Sony, and we had kind of done the original sort of outlining and scripting work. And for whatever reason, Sony wasn't interested in moving quite as quickly as Sega was. And so they kind of parted ways. And then Paramount very quickly jumped in and was interested in taking it over.
They had a deal with Neil Moritz, and he could bring them this. I don't know what point Jim Carrey gets involved, because obviously he's a big part of this picture.
Yeah, it really just kind of came down to like, who would be a great fit for this stuff. And Jim, just being one of the biggest comedy legends of all time, that just felt like a good person to talk to. And so he was shooting Kidding over on the Sony lot. And I came by and had a really great lunch meeting with him in his trailer and just kind of talked about what our plans were. I mean, he didn't really have any direct familiarity with the game, but it seemed like he was really excited about some of the stuff we were pitching. I mean, I think this, what he really kind of latched onto was the fun of playing a character that had an IQ of 300 and was a villain. I mean, it just felt like some interesting territory and some that he could have some fun with.
Because it seemed like he wasn't really wanting to be that kind of, you know, everybody keeps talking about, not since Ace Ventura have we seen this Jim Carrey, and we really haven't. Mm-hmm. He wanted to do more drama, serious stuff. Was he just ready to commit?
I think he was just ready to have fun, and you saw it. I really feel like it's a lighter film, but Jim has a very strong connection with children, and I think he really does enjoy creating entertainment for kids and hadn't done that in a while and saw Sonic as a way of kind of returning to that. And I just think he really values that.
I think the fans were happy to see
that
Jim Carrey back. So at what point do you design Sonic? Now we're approaching the bad part of the story. There's a happy ending.
We're moving into act two right now. we've got some challenges coming up.
So your thoughts when you were designing the character initially was that you felt like you had to move him a bit towards a human sort of look. Do I understand that right?
Realism is the word.
I mean, well, something that could be in the human world is what I meant.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So he has to have fur and he's got to have realistically rendered textures. And this all has to look like it
teeth,
blends.
Calves.
Yeah. Well, it was just all of that. And I think that there are areas where we just had gone too far with and there was too much realism and it needed to be dialed back. I don't think there was any part where everyone was like, could have predicted the way things were going to go. But in hindsight, there were signs. I mean, the fans were getting a little glimpse of the direction we were heading. And some of those concerns proved to just be validated by what was released.
So the trailer comes out. What's that day like?
Well, it was, you know, it's funny because like, I feel like the way these things are gauged, you have the post on YouTube and you're seeing the like to dislike ratio. And that really, I think, is probably the best indicator of how the public is responding to it. And very early in the morning, I mean, there could have been 10,000 views of the trailer, but it was weighted so heavily negative that it wasn't like, oh, let's just wait and see how the rest of the day plays out. I think whether it's 10,000 people or a million people, like the ratio of positive to negative pretty much stayed the same. And so kind of waking up to that and just knowing that it was probably only going to get worse was, yeah, I mean, it was definitely, that's a tough morning.
Did you think my movie is now screwed because these people now have created an idea about it that I can't make them unsee?
It definitely was cause for concern. What made it manageable was that I felt like we really did have a good movie. And so if we could figure out this design, if we could sort of crack this and find the sort of sweet spot between the Sonic we know we needed for the movie, which is a more realistic character than anyone's ever seen, but also bring back the aesthetic and the design cues that fans love about him as a character from the games, then we'd be in a great position.
I think you tweeted like quickly, right? Saying,
well, yeah, timing was very important. I really wanted the fans to know that like their opinion mattered and that they were heard and that we were going to get to work.
I mean, did you unilaterally do the tweet or did you say to everybody, can I do this tweet?
I didn't necessarily ask for permission, but I felt like I was saying what everyone else was thinking.
You thought you had the support.
But I wanted it to come from me because it's my movie, I mean, at the end of the day. And so I wanted to take ownership of it and not just let someone else have to step in to handle it. So
let me just read the tweet. We're talking about the tweet. Thank you for the support. Okay, that was nice. That part was nice of you to say. And the criticism, the message is loud and clear. You aren't happy with the design and you want changes. It's going to happen. Everyone at Paramount and Sega are fully committed to making this character the best, all caps, he can be. Hashtag Sonic movie, hashtag gotta fix fast. It's like everyone in Sega and Paramount aren't fully committed, we think. We're pretty sure.
I was pretty sure.
You were pretty sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't want
to. I mean, were you trying to make sure that they were committed with this tweet?
No, I felt like they really were. I guess I wanted to present a sort of a uniform front, right? That like because we really had the conversations. I wasn't speaking out of turn. I mean, we had talked about it. Sega and Paramount were completely on board with making changes. I just sort of took it on myself to get that message out.
Just send it out. Probably a good idea. I mean, I think the things were like the legs and the teeth or something.
I would say proportions is really what, at the end of the day, if you put the two designs side by side, the problem with our first design is that you're missing those big cartoony feet, those big cartoony hands, big cartoony eyes, and you're ending up in some territory which is kind of neither here nor there. He's not, like, there was never going to be a version where we just did like a real hedgehog the way Paddington Bear is a real bear. That version was never even planned for. So it just became, how do we take these like elements of realism and balance them with the cartooniness of Sonic's design? And so we just sort of brought back more of that cartooniness.
It feels so unusual for, you know, fandom can be really toxic. I don't need to tell you. We've seen it with a lot of properties.
Mm-hmm.
It's unusual to somehow, ironically maybe, break the video game curse with something that started out being despised by fans.
Yeah, it's quite a journey. But at the end of the day, it really is, it's feedback. I mean, it's funny because I was just thinking about the whole process. And I think a lot of filmmakers, you have test screenings and you pass out cards after the screening and you have them give you feedback. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? What did you like? What didn't you like? And then you actually incorporate that into the movie, or you have the option of incorporating it into the movie. And in some weird way, this sort of Sonic design was just an extension of that. It was a very public extension of that, but it was really putting something out there and having someone give you feedback on it.
I mean, I don't know if the studio even had any other ideas about how to detoxify the situation.
No, I think it was just, we got to fix the little blue guy.
You got to fix the blue guy.
Yeah, then make him great.
However unlikely, this has been, as we're speaking, the number one movie for 2 weeks now. Pretty nice, right? What was that celebration like? Everybody, when it opened, just go, I mean, I...
Yeah, definitely a sense of relief. And that, I mean, there's so many people and so much work and so much passion and so much talent goes into making these things. I mean, just for me, there was just a relief and pride in the film we made and then that people are responding to it the way they are, and just very appreciative of everyone that helped us get there. I mean, the cast, the crew, it's been an amazing week. I've just been getting great emails from everyone who worked on it, and they're just so happy and able to celebrate it too, as they should, because I mean, it just takes so many people to make these movies.
It is a huge operation. Did you have to redo any of the live action shooting too?
No, we actually, Sonic became kind of the only reshoot we did. I mean, there were no additional scenes filmed. The version of Sonic that Ben Schwartz had been performing in all our records was the same version through every version of the movie we created. So it was really just the little bit of cosmetic work we needed to do on Sonic's appearance.
Sonic makeover leads to Sonic boom.
Yeah, Sonic, the glow up is the word that I kept seeing, which I had never heard before, but that's just because I'm out of touch, I guess.
I have not heard that word. I'm just...
It's a glow up.
Okay,
Kim,
it's a glow up.
It's a glow up.
I think I need
it's
one of those.
It's a glow up of the year.
Jeff Fowler is the director of Sonic the Hedgehog. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Kim.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.